Hello, everyone, and welcome to Scale Ups and Downs, the podcast brought to you by Google for Startups, in which we invite startup founders to share the ups and downs of their journey to scale. I'm your host, Marta Krupinska, head of Google for Startups in the UK. Having co-founded three startups myself and made all sorts of mistakes and survived all kinds of trials and tribulations, I know that the key to success is surrounding yourself with the right people to find solutions together. So for each episode, I am joined by a panel of amazing experts, founders, investors, industry and field specialists to jointly discuss the challenges that our guest founders are dealing with. So this week, we'll be delving into what attracted most of us to the world of tech, product and innovation. Much to consider in this fundamental part of building a company with many tightropes to tread. Whether it's the balancing act of getting your product done versus making it perfect, the pros and cons of being a product-led company over one that is sales-led, or even whether you should be focusing on developing the best AI in the world or the best commercial products that your customers would want to buy. So lots of different kinds of challenges and questions we could be asking. But do we have the right people to answer the questions? Well, we most certainly do. I am so delighted to be joined by two incredibly accomplished individuals, Eric Collins and Dominic King. I'll ask them to introduce themselves in a moment, but a little bit of a background from me. So Eric is a serial entrepreneur. He served on boards and in the C-suite of fast growth technology companies for the past 20 years. Eric's experiences include AI, SaaS-based, mobile, and health technology companies. He has helped sell organizations to listed companies, including Microsoft and Nuance. And he's been named one of the most powerful Black and BAME business people in the UK by The Powerlist and the Financial Times. So Eric, I don't know how you found time to join us today, but thank you so much. How are you doing today?
Thank you, Marta, very much for having me. Of course, with respect to Google for Startups, I always think it's a good contribution of time and energy to be talking to your audience. So thank you for having me.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Eric. All right. So on to Dominic King. Dominic works at Optum as their senior vice president in clinical solutions. But actually, I first met Dominic when he was leading DeepMind Health and then Google Health. Before joining Google, Dominic was a clinical lecturer in surgery at Imperial, and now he continues to work there as an honorary clinical lecturer, supervising PhD students and contributing to applied research at the Institute of Global Health Innovation. This includes developing an AI system for breast cancer screening in conjunction with Google Health, and that was published in the Nature magazine in early 2020. Hugely accomplished panelists joining us today. Dominic, thank you so much for finding time. And how are you today?
Great. I very much, when I was at Google, enjoyed working with you and the startups. You brought an incredible bunch of people together. So excited to continue the conversation.
All right. Wonderful. Can't believe we let you go. But hey, for as long as we can keep you coming back, it's all good. All right. To kickstart the conversation, Eric and Dominic, I'd love a quick contribution from you. We're all here passionate about product, about innovation. You've both built many. Any company, startup, a particular innovative feature that you're either working on right now, have supported, or have actually seen that you think it's worth sharing with our audience? Anyone or anything that has particularly attracted your attention recently? Eric, want to kick us off?
Of course. There are so many. So ImpactX, the company that I helped start, which is a venture capital firm that focuses on underrepresented entrepreneurs. And we have a particular focus on women and people of color in the UK and Europe. The thing that I have noted is that among those demographics in almost every country, the use of AI as a technology enabler for whatever the solution is pretty ubiquitous. So if we have technology companies, AI is enabling that technology to be more effective and more efficient. And we invest in digital and technology as well as health, education, lifestyle. So in those two sectors, we find that there is a lot of activity. Specifically, when I think about who is doing fascinating things with AI, I think about two of the companies that are in our portfolio. One is a company called Marshmallow. Many people have heard about Marshmallow because when we invested as the $30 million pre-money valuation, and then 18 months later, they were $1.2 billion and became the second black unicorn in the UK. That organization has been talked about. They are using AI in a very specific fashion in order to make sure that they're addressing an underserved community, individuals who are either expats who have come to the UK or young people who generally have very expensive cost of insurance for their vehicles. How do you actually make sure that you're matching up people whose driving record is someplace else or who have little driving record and end up paying five times as much as other people here in the UK for their premiums on their insurance? How do you make them get the opportunity to get good value for money? That sort of applied consumer AI is a very simple approach, but something which is very useful and enables them to be much more aggressive in their pricing and much more effective in terms of their business model. So I love that organization. Before coming to ImpactX, though, there's another company that I work for, a company called Touch Surgery, which changed our name. We changed our name to Digital Surgery, and that is an organization that used AI. Specifically, if we think of AI, the places that I've run into AI has been machine learning, natural language processing, and computer vision. The last, computer vision is what we were using at Touch Surgery, at Digital Surgery, before we were acquired by the robotics division of Medtronic, because we were trying to figure out how do you help individuals who are surgeons and then the other people in the operating theater, how do you help them to identify sort of the right next step in order to get the gold standard result in a operation as opposed to creating complications and readmissions that might happen based on problems that occurred during the process. Those types of either health tech applications or, as I said, the insurtech application with Marshmallow are two examples of companies that I think are interesting, that I've one I've worked for and one that I'm working with currently. How is that?
Pretty fabulous. Thank you so much, Eric. Dominic, who's on your mind?
Well, I mean, I love this conversation is around like product and product mindset. It's a thing that a lot of people don't actually do very well, even though in some ways it's kind of simple. Like, have a clear vision, set some, you know, ambitious but achievable goals. But when you see things that don't go right, it's usually a failure in like a core part of that. Like, you've grown a team, and if you ask, you know, 10 random members of the team what you're building, they all give a different answer. I really love the bias for health tech here is the kind of doctor and nurse entrepreneurs and product leaders that we're seeing, particularly in the UK. Eric mentioned like Andre and Jean at Touch Surgery, fantastic, grew a business, sold it to, you know, major medical device company in the US. Ivan Beckley at Cervera, who I know you've been supporting, Marta. I met Ivan a couple of weeks ago. He was intern with us at DeepMind. I had breakfast last week with Yusuf, the CEO of Quit Genius, who's, you know, just done a big round. These guys have, like, they've come to understand what product is. And I did a startup that was very early stage acquisition from Google. And now I look back and I was super naive about the product process. We kind of winged it a little bit, but I see this new group of product leaders coming up. And they're doing like amazing things and growing and scaling companies in a way. And it's because they are product managers. They may be doctors or nurses or other people, but they're first and foremost product managers and product leaders.
Amazing. And well, you're about to meet two incredible founders building in this space. But before we go there, one more question each for you. So Eric, you talked about your passion about AI, ML, data. What's your view? How can founders bake in AI into their business from the earliest stages? And perhaps a related question, actually, should they? Everybody's so excited about AI right now. Should every product have an AI strategy?
That is an interesting question. You know, we invest in organizations who are doing innovative and disruptive things. We want to invest in organizations that just don't have a fantastic return on investment, but also change the world for the better. One of the reasons why we invest in women and people of color is because we believe that there is a sort of a consciousness that exists and a tenacity which exists as entrepreneurs that creates outsized results, that the risks are reduced and the opportunity for alpha is increased tremendously. When I think then about artificial intelligence as an opportunity to add more smarts, more speed, more dimensions to the thinking, more breadth of the solution set, that might not otherwise be available if we were just using our technologies that are a bit more sort of direct, this does this and therefore we're done, or we don't incorporate natural language processing, or we don't incorporate machine learning, or we don't incorporate computer vision, that if indeed we are absenting those sorts of dynamics from our consideration set of our product, are we actually getting the most disruptive, the most highest velocity opportunities for creation of value? Are we doing all those things? So I think that they should be considered for sure. I think they should be considered the same way that you consider data science, that you should consider the data that you're collecting from your consumers, from your customers, that should always be considered. And that all of those things are net additive to making sure that you have a better outcome for all the stakeholders who are around the table and help to improve the world in specific ways. So I'm not sure that it does. I don't know whether I can say for every company that artificial intelligence should be part of their product strategy. But if it has a possibility to actually increase and accelerate the things that I'm talking about, I'd love to see organizations, and organizations who we invest in who are able to give a good story about that are certainly going to get our attention more than people who don't have that sort of a story to tell.
Brilliant. Thank you, Eric. And Dominic, so you've been an academic, you've been a founder, you've worked in tech for all these years. In products, there's this principle of test and learn, especially in health tech. We're talking about regulated environments, a duty of care for the user. So this importance of testing is so high. Do you have any tips and tricks or how you think about balancing innovation and testing in health tech innovation?
I've lived this in a number of products that I've been involved in. As critical as in any product area that you have users and you have them looking over your shoulder at what you're doing and getting constant feedback. But people in this space, like lots of people are excited about health technology. They want to have a positive impact in the world. But the old adage from the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, right? That's a very important principle. And if your product can have great benefit in healthcare, it can also have great harm if it gives the wrong advice or disenfranchises certain groups. So people just need to be kind of eyes wide open. And I think they are in a way that maybe a few years ago wasn't so much the case. People need to know what constitutes like regulated products and when you're giving advice to a doctor or a patient about a medication, like you have to have the right safety and processes in place. And the companies I see now really are thoughtful about that in a way that maybe people weren't previously.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Gentlemen, I'm delighted to introduce you to the first of our founders today, Charlotte from Sano Genetics. Charlotte, your company has just hit a big milestone. So again, I'm delighted that you found time for us, but you're working in a very important space. The past couple of years, also the time of COVID, has been quite transformational. Please tell us about Sano Genetics and also tell us about your background, your story, and how you came to found Sano.
Great. Thanks, Marta, and thank you for inviting me. Yes, so Sano is in the space of precision medicine. So really, this is about transforming medicine in a way that is personalized to the individual. In our case, that includes a lot of genetics, but there are more and more aspects that are being taken into consideration in how we can find treatment and stratify patients based on much more refined criteria than just sort of sex, age group, ethnic origin, and actually come up with treatments that are adequate for these patients. So to give a bit of context of how Sano came to be, why I co-founded it, initially I started my career in investment banking and quickly realized that it wasn't for me. So I decided to apply for a degree in neuroscience at the University of Cambridge and went on to do my PhD looking at the embryonic origin of childhood cancer. So that's when genetics started to enter my life from a sort of developmental perspective. And during my PhD at the Sanger, I met Patrick and Will, my two co-founder, who were also doing their PhDs at the time in different fields. In fact, Will was applying machine learning to data sets, whereas Patrick was looking more at rare disease. The three of us really bonded over the fact that academic research and mostly the sort of inefficiencies around gathering data, harmonizing data, and analyzing data were really stifling scientists all over the world from doing actual research that matters. A lot of us, well, the three of us really experienced the complexity, in fact, in finding the right patient for the sort of experiments we wanted to do, in gathering the data, in dealing with data sets that are in all kind of different formats and a real headache to sort of like get any meaning from. So this is where Sano was born, really. We were having that experience of speaking to patients who were insanely frustrated by the research process and weren't really learning anything useful. And on the other hand, we were also meeting scientists, you know, who were just struggling to really get the information they wanted. So we built that platform And initially we came at it with quite a naive idea, you know, of patient matchmaking with research institution. And we thought, you know, if patients could actually directly interact, you know, with research institutions around the world and have access to all kind of clinical trials and research, then we would have access to a bigger bank of data. And that would be an interesting experience for the patient. Obviously, the business has evolved a lot since. We've built our genetics capabilities. So a big part of what we're doing, in fact, now is to offer free genetic sequencing to patients in the key conditions that we're looking into. And we're working with organizations like NIHR Bioresources or Genomics England, and we basically provide that patient platform to sit on top of these existing databases so that patients can play a role in accessing their data, in participating in research, in providing additional information. But on our side, we're also playing a big part in harmonizing this data and actually make it possible for researchers all around the world to analyze it in a way that makes sense. So I think, as you may have guessed, my challenge for you, Dominic and Eric, will come very much from a sort of like data sourcing and data harmonizing perspective.
Fascinating, Charlotte. Thank you so much. And yeah, without further ado, what thoughts are you bringing to the table today, and how can we help?
Yeah, so my first challenge to you is, you know, there has been lots of progress in machine learning algorithms in the past years. And I think we're seeing really clear signal that it can play an incredible role in improving the quality of healthcare. But a big challenge to making this a reality at the moment is data scarcity and also sort of like scrappiness of the data. Between one data set to the other, it's not always comparable. And that makes the findings, you know, of initial sort of like machine learning algorithms sometimes not robust enough to be applicable in the real world. So do you feel like solving the data problem in a way on the large scale and trying to find solution for different companies to generate high quality data and to develop systems to actually compare these different types of data should maybe happen before we invest more and more into refining algorithms?
I'm happy to kick off. Great question, Charlotte. So data quality is clearly an issue in healthcare. There has been good progress over the last, you know, decade or so, despite, you know, concerns and issues, say, clinicians have with EHRs. Clearly, having an increasing amount of health data captured digitally is a major advantage here. And then obviously medical imaging, say, when I qualified as a doctor in the early 2000s, we were still using kind of x-rays you'd put up, you know, printed out. Every x-ray is digitalized now. So we're seeing data improve. We're seeing standards, common standards, interoperability standards. We're seeing legislation that is pushing progress. And companies and other organizations also really respect the need for that inherent interoperability. The challenge, I would say, is in, you know, previous efforts and in continuing efforts I do in this space, is that a lot of teams spend a lot of effort curating data sets, these imaginary nirvanas of health data that they then train and test an algorithm in and publish great papers in. And that is often so different from like normal production data, like a feed goes down or actually you don't have these key results that you've spent an age curating. And my kind of push to teams that I work with now is, if you care about production and real world impact, less so about papers, what's the best you can do with the way the data currently is? Because working within a data set that may take years or decades to actually realize in production is setting yourself up for getting the paper, but never getting into production. So then there's a question of, can, is machine learning actually useful with the limited data sets or issues that you see in live systems? That's like another question that needs to be answered. But if you care about impact, work as close to production data as you can.
The only thing that I would add is, so I think it's a great question, Charlotte. And this is one of the challenges that we had at Touch Surgery / Digital Surgery. When I came from the United States, I moved here about 8 years ago, and I had been used to, one of the good things about the UK is with the single payor system, the data set for some aspects of health is relatively systematic in terms of it's sort of a little bit clean in that way. and it is a large number that can be accessed for public reasons. At least you can have an opportunity to access it for public reasons for the public benefit. In the United States, that's very different, right? By state, locality by locality, insurance company by insurance company. It's just miserable, even with electronic data records. So trying to actually access the right data sets is one thing. So access is an issue. If you've gotten over the access issue, what we found at Touch Surgery is that for the sake of computer vision, we needed to be able to tag images. And, you know, some people would tag images from one college or university or some residency program in one way, and others would do it another way. We ended up having to actually have our own internal team to go through. Dan Stoynoff, who is at Imperial and in dealing with robotics and the like, in order to get to the solution that we wanted, which was production version, as Dominic said, we had to go through and hire individuals to actually take the data that we were actually seeing to sanitize it. And this takes so much time. And if you're thinking about production, you're thinking about hitting your milestones, you're thinking about your next funding round, it just is a pain in the neck, right? And so you have to make a decision relatively early. Are you going to be able to do that? What do you have to do in order to get over the problems and the inefficiencies which exist and the absolute dead ends that exist in order to be able to move forward in the way that you have said to your funders, in the way that you have said to your customers that you're going to be able to do? And that is the issue for you as a entrepreneur. You're going to have to decide that, and you're going to have to decide it pretty quickly. It's not one of those you can just, you know, kick down the road, because it will determine everything and your burn rate and your net burn, your gross burn. It'll do all those sorts of things and put you in a really poor position. I'm glad that you've just raised capital. I'm glad you're asking this question. It is the perfect question to be asking right now. And I do think Dominic's answer is correct, but I would say answer the question for yourself as quickly as possible. Do what you need to in order to put in place what you're going to need in order to get to production, and so that you can hit your milestones, you can raise again, unless you think you're going to go public or you think you're going to be cash flow neutral or positive by the end of this funding cycle. That's what I would say.
Great. Thanks, Eric. I mean, it's definitely interesting to hear about that trade-off, you know, between sort of perfect data set versus like impact and getting things done. I think, you know, from our perspective as a company, it's pretty much the premises of what we have built is to actually sort of centralize data from disparate sources and actually make it readily available for analysis in a way that makes sense. And so I'm just curious, in terms of, you focus a lot on machine learning, but do you sort of see as well the space for companies that are not necessarily in machine learning, but like very data focused in terms of curating these data sets or improving data for the purpose of machine learning research, having a huge place as well in this area? And do you think that somewhat finding ways of joining the different players in the field, biobanks, you know, pharma companies, etc., around common interest is something that could be a game changer in that field?
When you think about what you would be willing to give up in terms of that, you would say that I am going to turn over that sort of responsibility to some other organization and that I'm going to rely upon them and I would then pay them for it. Do you think that that is a very valuable part, and you'd be willing to pay a great deal of capital so that you are saying that there is actually for you a pound figure or a dollar figure that is something you'd be willing to contribute from your expense line to this thing? And if you actually were able to do that, you would be able to offload some of your costs from your own P&L?
Yes, it's a part of it for sure. But I would say it goes beyond cost. I think it has to do with sort of like the scale of the data and the reach. So it's not just a question of, I think, for companies, whether they do it internally or just outsource that. It's also the sort of like scale of data that they can reach individually as a company versus using potentially a platform like ours, you know, in terms of accessing multiple databases in the world in one instance without having to sort of reconcile the data themselves.
I think that there's certainly a market for that. I think it would be very, very beneficial. I haven't seen it done in a way that any of the organizations from our grid with Amber Hill straight through to anyone else that I can think of in our portfolio who is actually accessing such a great source of data. But if one existed, I think they've specialized in terms of data and then being able to utilize that reliably for the training of their algorithms and their business models.
Yeah. If you think of a care delivery organization like the National Health Service in the UK or Optum in the United States, right, we generally care about two things, right? One, what's the best care we can deliver today? And then what does the future of care look like, and how can we continue to iterate and improve? Now, let's look at this kind of interoperability challenge from like today. If you're a patient or if you're a clinician, you could go to your primary care physician and have a blood test, and then you see the specialist this afternoon. They don't have access to it. So we know there's challenges in interoperability from that perspective. Likewise, if you're a research scientist, if you had that universal canonical record of care, you know, with all the trust and privacy protections in place, you support both direct care activities, but also cutting edge research. If you're a research scientist, you're often having to do a lot of stuff that if the platform existed, the data platform existed, you could just concentrate on your differentiated product or like effort. So there's a huge effort going underway. There's efforts going underway in care delivery organizations, like I just mentioned. There's the big cloud organizations like Google Cloud, Azure, AWS that are working to bring data together. There's the big EHRs. There's other, you know, a number of big, well-funded kind of Valley companies, Commuer, Innovaser, Zeus. Like lots of people recognize that the potential of bringing data together. And we're definitely seeing progress towards that, but you know, it's a lot slower than we'd either like for today's care, as well as what you are building, which is like tomorrow's care, to really be as effective as possible.
Thanks, Bruce.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And I think I love that not only are we getting some insights for the founders, both on the call, on the podcast and listening to the podcast, but I'm also hoping that there are other people in the space. I don't know, should people be picking up ideas? You know, are there businesses to start there? Are there public-private partnerships to be started to increase the quality of innovation that entrepreneurs like the ones today that we're getting to speak to could benefit from? So brilliant. Thank you so much for this, Charlotte. And congratulations on everything that you and your co-founders have been achieving these past few years. Charlotte, how do we find you online? How do we find out more about Sano? Can you give us some social media credentials to follow?
Absolutely. So Sano Genetics, you can follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, all of the social media, you name it. And if you want to find out a bit more about me, Charlotte Goodzo, I'm on LinkedIn, always open to new connections, so feel free to reach out.
And I have a sense, as you just raised a nice round, you'll probably be hiring. So anyone in particular that should be looking at you for an exciting new opportunity?
That is absolutely right. We're definitely scaling quite fast, and we're recruiting pretty much in every department at the moment, commercial, tech, product. So please do get in touch. And yes, there is definitely space at the moment in pretty much every area of the business.
All right, fantastic. And we know how important talent is. And also, if you missed the first episode of this podcast, which was very much about hiring and building teams, definitely would refer you to that one. Charlotte, thank you so much. And I'm delighted to invite Julia Fan Lee to join us. Julia has the most fascinating background. When I think about everything from, again, fantastic academic credentials to experience as an investor to now being a founder of this fascinating organization, I'm so happy to have you on Scale Ups and Down. Julia, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself and your business Micrographia Bio?
Super. Hi, Marta. Lovely to be on the podcast with everybody on product and innovation. Micrographia Bio is a deep tech bio business. We are leading in a specialized field called spatial proteomics. And it's fascinating to hear about the work that Charlotte's been doing at Sano Genetics, as I spent half of the last decade in the genomics field. And it's great now to sort of understand how genomics mixes, which is the DNA or the blueprint of life, then gets translated into mRNA, which I think everyone has been hearing a lot during COVID. But our hypothesis is that it's really the proteins that the mRNA encodes that are the workhorses of the cell. And so as we understand our blueprint, the messenger, what we really want to understand is the 20,000 plus proteins in each of our cells that enable us to function, and the difference between a healthy functioning cell versus a diseased cell state. So a little bit about me. I am a recovering venture capitalist. You're correct. My PhD was on the topic of innovative financing for global health entrepreneurs. I was thinking about this problem about entrepreneurs who work on diseases like TB and malaria, and how they didn't have very big access to capital, they only had access to grants such as the Gates Foundation or the Wellcome Trust, but they couldn't get to Sand Hill Road and they couldn't access funding in the same way that an oncology entrepreneur or an Alzheimer's entrepreneur could. And so my PhD was on this intersection of how do we increase the pie of risk capital for entrepreneurs in infectious diseases. And I ended up raising a $108 million first-time global health investment fund with the Gates Foundation and JP Morgan. So it was very much this contrarian bet at the beginning that we can make good impact in financial and social returns at the same time. And that's something that drives me continuously in my work to date. I've been very fortunate to have my whole career working in the biotech space, but I think my passion for coming to this podcast is now I'm transitioning from biotech to tech bio. And it's this wonderful intersection of machine learning, biology, big data, all coming to enable the discovery of new medicines much faster and hopefully much cheaper for developers and for patients alike. In this new paradigm of tech bio, we are coming at it from a new product perspective. And that's my question to the group today is when we traditionally think about product market fit in the biotech or life sciences community, we think about how we match the right therapeutic to the right patient. So the drug is the ultimate product. But when we come at it from making machine learning platforms that accelerate the speed of discovery, it's actually the platform that is the first product. It's the first product that needs to work well, needs to work at scale before you hit the ability to disrupt the end product, which is the medicines. And so thinking about that, how should we think about allocating capital between the product that is the platform and the product that is the ultimate product market fit of the drug?
Going back to my intro around get like that product mindset and just having those clear things in place. You know, there's always that tension, I think, between product and platform and which one are you building? But who do you see as your customer in these kind of this early phase?
Yes, in our early phase, we launched during the pandemic, so March 2020, great timing. But we have launched in this time where we've seen Accenture, an Oxford-based AI for drug discovery company, go public. And we sort of borrow a page from their books that they validate the technology or the platform with customers as they go along, and then ultimately have their own internal pipeline of drug assets as well.
So for you then, Julia, your platform is an enabler. And by having a robust, good platform, it allows you to have more drug therapies to be produced down the line. So if it works really, really well, byproduct is more and better byproduct. And that would be a big differentiator also in your organization versus other organization. So it feels to me that I like your question, is the first product that you're looking at actually your platform? Because that is, you know, it's sort of the robot that you need to build in order to assemble cars faster. You need to be able to have that in place. So you know sort of what the outcome that you'd like to see ultimately, but in order to get there, this is the thing that has never been done that you need to do. And possibly, quite frankly, along the way, you find that that is the product itself that is valuable to other organizations. You license it or you use that as part of a business model. Either it becomes a black box and just becomes your own secret sauce, you know, your own trade secret, or it's something that you might say is part of our business model and something that we share more broadly. We share with countries that, like with COVID, we share with countries that don't necessarily have the same sorts of underlying infrastructures and ecosystems to develop. And so there may be a variety of ways in which you can leverage this. So in my opinion, I don't know if you have to answer the question either or just yet. I do believe that you invest heavily in the platform. You make that your differentiator, make it as robust as possible, decide whether or not, therefore, it's a trade secret or it's something that might have its own sort of market, and then you can go from there. But I do love the idea that then the byproducts will come faster and they'll be better. And the byproduct would be the medications, the therapies, whatever is coming out.
Perhaps I can follow on from here, and maybe in your experience as sitting to entrepreneurs pitching you these new tech bio ideas, how do you sort of think about the divide either with your bio investing hat on or your tech investing hat on? Because you'd be looking for different metrics or KPIs that showcase the level of building either for the first use case platform or the ultimate use case platform.
To be honest, Julia, we have never found ourselves in a position to invest in a bio company. we spend all of our time looking at the tech side. So if you were to come to us, we'd be looking at the technology side, because from our perspective, the cost and the scalability, so the amount of capital which is required, but you know this, you've been a venture capitalist, and so you know this, it's just the scalability which is associated with bits and bytes is so different, and the opportunity for pivots, the opportunity to make quick decisions, there's a whole different kind of sort of a DNA around those sorts of organizations than organizations that are heavily based on figuring out solutions to complicated problems like biological problems. And so, you know, I don't actually have very good information for you there.
I think in my experience today, looking at biotech companies, it's very disease focused. So you come either as a diabetes company, a cancer company, and you have a therapeutic that you're already thinking of. And that risk is quite binary. In the main, if you're going through clinical trials or even early discovery, the science works or it doesn't work for that disease. I think the way we have our product mindset internally at Micrographia Bio at the product level is that we are the platform and we de-risk that binary risk. We have a platform that can increase the speed of any therapeutic program. We can see the biology better at the protein level for any potential therapeutic you want to test for, including the ones that we test for ourselves. And so we are de-risking the ultimate company risk by having a platform embedded in the business model. But it is very non-traditional. And therefore, when it falls on ears that are used to the traditional model, there is a bit of dissonance.
Are you seeing the timelines on those KPIs? Do they feel very different to you with the tech focus?
With the machine learning aspect of the stack that we have today, I see a huge acceleration of timeline in my experience coming from genomics to what we use now, which is microscopy and computer vision for imaging. What used to take me in my last business 3 years to complete on the genomic side will take 3 months here with the accelerated AI on microscopy. And so it's that speed that excites me as an entrepreneur, but ultimately we need to prove that use case to getting medicines faster. And that is what's exciting in the next 10 years to come.
So it's interesting, as I listen to, and we take a step up from sort of exactly what the organization does to sort of its ethos and what it is going to accomplish, it reminds me of an organization, at least in terms of this, the company which is in our portfolio. It's a company called R-Grid, Research Grid, that started by Amber Hill. And the whole purpose is to make sure that we can get therapies to market more quickly. So if she's talking about it, in some ways as a venture capitalist, I hear some similarities. The interesting thing is the choice was made by this organization that we are going to invest in increasing the likelihood that organizations are able to get through clinical trials. So not that we're going to be using proteins and the like in order to be able to get to the solution, but that we're more at the platform level. We are doing things with the documentation and with the testing that has to happen, all of the things which will eventually go to the FDA or that will go for our C marking here. How do we make sure that those things move along with as little grit in the system as possible? Because what is it, 80% of organizations that actually start a process of trying to get a therapy approved, it just never happens. And so there's just such inefficiency that exists. And are there ways to improve that process? Her customers then end up being the research institutions, the medical device companies, the pharmaceutical companies, who then utilize this tool in order to be able to move more quickly and to get a higher likelihood. So the probabilities of getting a good outcome are increased by what is being done using the R-Grid as a system. That's what I hear. So that's how we would look at something like this and say, we like that kind of a solution. And then we don't get to test really the question that you're asking. Dominic's questions are very good ones, but we just don't get to test them, because we would come at this another way and say, are there ways of using just the technology that's associated with sort of the writing, the research, and those sorts of things, as opposed to what are we researching about in the proteins and other sorts of things? We wouldn't get into that. So that would be at least an answer as to how I would look at the situation and where I would invest as an investor.
It's such a pleasure to listen to this conversation. I'm also, as I'm listening to you, and I think we're getting insights for individual companies, but I think there are some industry level insights from this discussion on how to just drive forward product and innovation, especially in the health space, from better access to data, maybe informing some entrepreneurs that come from bio backgrounds on how to position and spin their products and platforms using the language that's used by tech, then helps unlock capital that has higher risk appetite that we're seeing in tech. I think as I'm also seeing, as we're talking about product innovation, I think we need to pivot the format of this podcast, because I've definitely got four experts here, and I think we need a V2, where probably is Eric and Dominic that you guys are asking the ladies the questions, because I think that would also be fascinating to see what we could learn from this reverse coaching or peer coaching. Thank you so much. This is fantastic. And I'll definitely be spending some time learning more about Micrograph Your Bio. So thank you so much, Julia. How do we find more about you? And also, I'd love just a quick follow-up question. So your first time fund, 108 million. I'd love to hear a couple of companies that you backed that you were particularly excited about. Maybe we should have them on the podcast next.
Oh gosh, yes, we can start there on the fun side. Great entrepreneurs in the infectious disease space. I'll highlight two companies. One is a South Korean-based vaccine manufacturer called EU Biologics. The GHIF fund was a first investment check in that as they were spinning up off the ground in about 2013, 2014. And our investment there helped them scale up vaccine manufacturing in South Korea for the cholera vaccine. Cholera is an infectious disease, but the world does not have enough vaccines in the supply chain. And we know that the scientific risk was de-risked because the vaccine IP and know-how is known. There was just not enough manufacturing capacity. So our investment in that company allowed us to double the world supply of cholera vaccine and make a great investment for the fund. So that's an example of why a risk capital approach works very well over a grant-based only approach.
It's fascinating. I've definitely had conversations with investors, including investors, for instance, in AstraZeneca, where, you know, there have been questions of, you know, why would venture capital go into the space of vaccines? And then obviously the world changed quite dramatically. And many of these investors were then called visionaries that were really ahead of their time. But in fact, it's often, you know, how things play out and how markets play out that then decide who wins and who loses.
Can I ask a question, Julia? Because my understanding is that in the vaccine space in particular, and your congratulations, now there's some foresight, 2013, well done, that we find that there are the sexy, you know, therapies, and then there are the things which exist in our world that are no longer sexy, and therefore there's not really a great business model around them. Cholera is fascinating because it really is one of those sort of old diseases that's an infectious disease that no one's really that interested in. It's not COVID. So that was something, though. Is it because of the Gates Foundation and their particular interest in that type of thing? Or was it, you know, that you said that there's really a great business case around going with a old disease state that has been around forever and looks like it's going to be around for a long, long time?
It's probably both. One, on the scientific aspect, it's a great business case because we know the disease, we know how to prevent it. It's a supply-demand issue. The Global Alliance for Vaccines says that the world needs 20 million doses a year, and current supply levels were 2 million doses. And so when the earthquake happened in Haiti, it was a terrible disaster because the world knew how to prevent cholera, but they couldn't deploy enough vaccines, and therefore they chose not to deploy the vaccines. And so if we had a stockpile or an ability for more entrepreneurs to come in and fill that gap on a for-profit basis, then the world would be better for it in terms of preparedness. And then on to final note about Micrographia. You can find us on LinkedIn and micrographiabio.com. And if you have an interest in turning biological insights with machine learning and data science, we are also actively hiring in London.
Amazing. Charlotte, Julia, Eric, Dominic, thank you. This has been fascinating. When we set out to do this podcast, the team and I had a conversation that we need to make sure that this isn't just Startups 101, because there is a lot of content out there like that. I'm pretty sure this was not Startups 101. This was barely Startups 102. I definitely feel I'm one inch closer to a PhD just from spending an hour with you. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate this. This has been Scale Ups and Downs, brought to you by Google for Startups with our wonderful speakers, Charlotte Guzzo, Julia Fanley, Dominic King, and Eric Collins. Now, if you've enjoyed this, please subscribe to the podcast. But also, we would love to hear from you if you're a founder experiencing challenges. And I mean, if you're a founder and you don't have any challenges, I would love to meet you too, because I am yet to meet one. Please go to scaleupsanddowns.com and please submit a question that you might have to a panel that we will be putting together. We'd love to have you on the podcast, hear from you, and together change the way we think about asking questions, being experts, sort of modeling vulnerability and showing that sometimes it's the entrepreneurs that are asking the best questions that will be most successful rather than the ones that think that they've already got all the answers. Thank you so much for joining me today. Have a wonderful rest of your day and hear you next time.